Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Revolutionary Observers, two conversations about political change in the modern world this week on Soundings. First on the program this week, Mel Richter discusses his study of Alexis de Tocqueville, the 19th century observer of European and North American politics and culture. Mel Richter teaches at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Following my conversation with Mel Richter, the topic will be contemporary intellectual cross-currents between the United States and the Soviet Union. My guest on that portion of the program will be the first Soviet scholar to hold a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He's Nikita Pokrovsky of Moscow State University. Joining in that conversation will be Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. According to Mel Richter, Alexis de Tocqueville was an important analyst and prescient observer of the two empires constructed by Napoleon Bonaparte and Louis Bonaparte after the great French revolutions of 1789 and 1848. Tocqueville took a particular interest in the Bonapartist dictatorship, which he saw as a perversion of the democratic ideal. Here is Mel Richter.
Well, one of the qualities of Tocqueville that attracts people at first and then perhaps repels them later is that he was prophetic and that he did make predictions. But of course, in my view, the predictions are not as important as the questions he asked and the way that he analyzed the questions. Mm-hmm. So that there is a striking prophecy, for example, at the end of the first part of Democracy in America, the 1835 volume, in which he predicts that the two great powers that are going to dominate the world are going to be the United States and Russia.
Let me bring you to your project here at the Humanities Center. Why was Tocqueville interested in the French Revolution? We've got two of them to talk about. Let's begin with 1789. What was going on? What was his interest?
Well, in part, it was personal. His family was an aristocratic family, and his mother and father were supposed to be guillotined during the Terror. And they were reprieved just by the fall of Robespierre, mm-hmm. And the Committee on Public Safety. So his family was very intimately involved. One of his most illustrious ancestors was a man called Miles Abe, who had served as a minister under the old regime and had advocated reforms. But then during the revolution, when the King of France was put on trial, Miles Abe volunteered to defend him, and he was put to death along with the king for mm-hmm. having done so. So the revolution was enormously personal in that particular sense, but also Tocqueville thought that the most significant trend in the world of his time was the push towards equality. Now, equality is a very slippery term.
Like liberty.
Like liberty. And indeed, part of Tocqueville's analysis that is most interesting is precisely in the relationship between liberty and equality.
What did he think? How should they work?
Well, he thought both of them were great things. And he thought that the achievement of the French Revolution before it had become excessive, was to bring about the end of distinctions based on birth, so that he had no desire to denigrate in any way the value of equality. However, the point that he wanted to make, and this was a point he was never tired of making, was that equality and liberty, although both eminently desirable,
conflict with one another. Do they?
They may conflict with each other.
You have a paradox at work.
Well, in his view, if you recognize intellectually that they're both desirable, but that they are not necessarily compatible, then you can recognize that some sort of a trade-off is necessary.
All right, and how did he fall on that question? Did he say that one necessarily takes precedence over the other?
Well, he cared more about liberty than he did equality. But there's an interesting point here, because he thought that equality was an irreversible trend in the society of Europe and the Western world. And so the question was not whether there would be equality, but what kind of equality, an equality with or without liberty.
How did that picture change? How did Tocqueville's perceptions change over a span of approximately 50 years, 1789 through, 1848, before our taping session? You said that this is a critical year in your approach to an understanding of Tocqueville.
Well, essentially, I think Tocqueville remained relatively consistent in his view. But I think that returning to the question of equality and its relationship to democracy, that the Tocqueville was very anxious to make clear that democracy and liberty are not necessarily associated. Now, we have a way these days, from the President of the United States on down to all our newspapers and the media, of referring to the sort of government that we like, in other words, sort of government that we think we have, as being democratic. Now, Tocqueville, I think, would have wanted to say that every form of government has certain advantages and presents certain dangers, and that it's important to identify the dangers so that one can take the steps in advance, such as recognizing that a democratic government ought to have limitations upon it as well as any other kind of government, and to see how it is that out of democracy you can get results which are incompatible with liberty. And I think that that is one of the reasons why I'm so interested in my project, which is what Tocqueville thought about Napoleon Bonaparte and his nephew Louis Napoleon, and the phenomenon which is called Bonapartism.
All right, now be specific for me. Tease out a couple of historical threads here and set a stage and identify some players for me.
Right. Well, I think that Tocqueville thought that there was a form of democracy which he thought, on the whole, the United States embodied remarkably well, although not completely. And that was a form of democracy which basically limited government and ensured liberties for the citizens, including the liberty to participate in politics. However, democracy based upon a nominal suffrage does not necessarily produce results of that sort. And I think that the experience, the historical experience of Napoleon Bonaparte, first of all, was one of the warning signals that he wanted to give us.
In what way? Are you talking about factionalism, or are you talking about how exactly does the paradox operate here?
Well, quite specifically, Napoleon Bonaparte came to power by a military coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. In other words, he seized power through armed force.
Now, this was very early in the 19th century. Is that
That's right? It was still in the 18th century.
It's still in the 1798, something like that?
Yeah, 1797.
Okay.
And the way that worked was something like this. Napoleon saw the opportunities for him to present himself as a democratic choice. And he saw the opportunity to cash in on the sense in the country that the representative government, the elected government, was ineffectual, corrupt, and indecisive.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was then, representing himself as the representative of the will of the people, was that after he seized power...
He declared it a democracy.
No. He held a plebiscite.
I see. Let the people do that.
That's right. That's right.
Does this sound like General Noriega?
Well, there are some questions about just how manipulated the election was. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, I think the verdict was that those who voted did endorse him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, this is a version of democracy which I think is very, very important. I mean, it's sometimes called Bonapartism. It's sometimes called Caesarism.
Right.
It's sometimes called plebiscitary dictatorship.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, there are many, many examples of this, particularly in Latin America. Now, I think...
Not to mention Mr. Marcos.
Yes.
All right.
Well, Mr. Marcos was elected, and then he declared a state of emergency, which never ended.
Uh-huh.
But I think that that Bonapartism, in this sense, is going to arise in the wake of all the quite wonderful developments that we're experiencing.
Well, let's pause on that, and let's talk, as I said a few minutes ago, let's talk in terms of some of these historical analogies. It is always dangerous, I understand, for you political historians to look for direct echoes or direct predictions.
Sure.
But again, you said that 1848 figures as a year which was momentous in European history, and to which we can look back and find some analogies that may have some startling news for us. Is this right?
Well, yes. I mean, they're rather frightening analogies in the sense that when 1848 began, it seemed to be an absolutely wonderful, incredible year, rather like the year that we've been experiencing in 1989-90.
Right.
And the Germans were holding a constitutional convention, which was to install a liberal government. Metternich, who ruled the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, was being very badly shaken. There were revolts in Hungary, and then I believe in Poland as well. There was a peaceful revolution in France in 1848, in which the king abdicated without there being fighting in the streets. And so it all looked like a wonderful future.
And yet this might have been the most dangerous moment of all. Have I got this right?
Well, yes. I mean, because what it turned out to be was that that out of this came the organization of international society, which basically led to the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And the explosion of nationalisms and the creation of a European state system, which created the two world wars of the 20th century.
Is it possible that you see the same sort of pattern repeating itself here with this explosion of democracy that we have been witnessing over the past 18 months, 2 years?
Well, I think all of us have to wait and see. But I think one of the key things to look for are the developments in societies which, on the one hand, like Czechoslovakia, have had democratic and constitutional institutions in the past, and those like Romania, like Bulgaria, like the Soviet Union, which have not had that kind of history, mm-hmm. and where the population doesn't understand this kind of need for a trade-off between liberty and equality, between order and their newly found freedoms, mm-hmm. Of expression and of action. And so it seems to me that on the basis of past history, that one very real possibility, particularly in places like Romania, where it has happened before, that the call for democracy, which is genuine and heartfelt, may end up by having a single person, perhaps a military figure, who then represents the people. In other words, such a person would claim that he or she rules because the people want them to. Uh-huh. Such a person rules directly. Such a person rules in the name of the people, in the interests of the people, is decisive, and can act in their good without having to go through all the haggling, uh-huh. All the compromises, all the discussions.
All the negotiations. The name Fidel Castro comes to mind. Have I got a bad parallel running there?
Well, the Castro analogy is a little more complicated because of the Marxist-Leninist framework out uh-huh. of which he operates. Uh-huh. In a democracy, the political leaders flatter the public.
Right.
And they therefore say, you know, we are number one. The United States is always the greatest in the world.
Triumphalism.
Well, yes. And of course, it's a real question, as Tocqueville put it, whether you can react adequately to problems and to crises if you're always being told that you are the best and will always be so.
Mel Richter teaches at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Mel Richter worked on a study of Alexis de Tocqueville. Soundings on Revolutionary Observers continues. My guests now are Nikita Pokrovsky of Moscow State University and Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Our topic is intellectual cross-currents between the United States and the Soviet Union. Nikita Pokrovsky recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center. Nikita, tell me about some of the exchanges that you've had with the American intelligentsia, the intellectuals of this country. You've been remarkably free in your ability to travel. Minnesota, New York, Washington, the Southeast. Tell me about that.
Ohio. As well. So I was really remarkably free to travel, and I enjoyed very much this opportunity to see more people. And I was really very much pleased to get to know how people were interested in knowing more about the Soviet Union or my research. And after a year spent here, I have maybe 10 times more friends mm-hmm. than I used to have before. And this is my real baggage, you see, or, mm-hmm. Which I am bringing back with me to the Soviet Union.
Bob Connor?
I just wondered, I wanted to ask Nikita whether he found in this traveling, whether the charge that I hear fairly often is true, that the Americans, particularly some American intellectuals, tend to be rather smug, rather we told you so about the Soviet Union at this point.
Yeah, you just touched the point. Very often it's true that intellectuals as well as people who represented different other circles of the society ask me a certain, questions about the Soviet Union, but mm-hmm. They were much more interested, as I understand, in just me confirming their own positions rather than expressing mine. And at the point when I began saying something which didn't fit their own expectations, they got a little bit confused, or they wanted to persuade me to think their own way.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you to reflect on this, Nikita Pokrovsky and Bob Connor. Bob, is Marxism dead? Nikita, is Marxism dead? What do you think, Bob Connor?
Well, I think there's a lot of Marxism that has been assimilated into the thought patterns beyond the specific ideological and political applications of it. But as a cogent force for reshaping the world, it seems to me we've seen the day.
How about this, Nikita?
Oh, thank you, Wayne, first of all, for one of your famous questions, you know, kicks, I would add. First of all, I would say Marxism is absolutely dead as a social religion, uh-huh. but it will never be dead as a philosophy, as well as Plato is not dead, Aristotle is not dead, Thomas Aquinas is not dead, and Marx is not dead either.
Well, let me rephrase it then. What is it in Marxism that will continue to exert pressure, a weight, a shape in the intellectual world, particularly in this exchange between the Americans and the Soviet scholars?
Well, you know, Marxism is very strong in economic analysis of the society, in shaping the class structure of the society, and making a theory of capitalism, private enterprise. So whatever is wrong or right in Marxism, it's functional in many ways. It's useful for many people, and it's appealing to certain clusters or strata of the society, so it will leave.
Mm-hmm. What about this, Nikita Pokrovsky? How do Soviet scholars think about the aims of scholarship? In this country, there is the assumption, at any rate, that scholarship in some indirect fashion contributes to the body politic, that there is a role that it plays in the moving forward of the social enterprise. Now, we've been assuming that that's the case in the Soviet Union. Is it, in fact?
Let me say something on behalf of myself rather than on specialists in humanities in general. First of all, I think there are two extremes, two poles. The first is that humanities or specialists in humanities go to a sort of the ivory tower, or the opposite is when they are entirely absorbed by political institutions. Uh-huh. Well, I believe that people in humanities, let me express my mind, can occupy a position somewhere in between these two poles. And on the one hand, they should be obviously independent to the extent they can from political institutions. But on the other hand, they should contribute to these institutions through their research and their moral message, which is hidden in their research as such, I believe, to the developments or development of political structures. I'm sorry for such a long monologue.
Uh-huh. Bob Connor, did I just get an answer, or what did we just hear from Nikita? How does that square with the aims of American scholarship?
Well, I'm very interested in this, because what Nikita's bringing out is the question of the morality between the lines, I guess you might call it, the ethical values, the societal values, and enter into scholarship sometimes not with the explicit agenda, but implicitly there. And what I'm hearing Nikita saying is that there's a sense shaping new Soviet scholarship, which is much more prepared to get at some of these implicit value issues. I think that's also true to some extent in recent developments in United States scholarship, though whether it's the same sort of concern, I'm not sure.
Nikita, do you think of yourself as a patriot first, a scholar first? How do you balance the act between your love of country and love of scholarship?
I do not make any distinction between both, and I would be a poor scholar if I don't like my country and my home in general, or vice versa. And it's sort of the combined feeling of being an objective researcher and at the same time a person who is a spokesman of your own country and your own nation.
Mm-hmm. Nikita Pokrovsky, it's been a great pleasure to have you at the Humanities Center. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate this very much.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Nikita Pokrovsky and Robert Connor. Nikita Pokrovsky teaches at Moscow State University. He was the first Soviet scholar to hold a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a study of American transcendentalism and citizenship. Robert Connor is director of the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 531. That's program number 531. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week on Soundings, conversations about liberal education and American secondary schooling. My guests will include several participants in the programs for high school teachers of history and literature that recently convened at the National Humanities Center. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the Monroe Doctrine, set forth by President James Monroe in early December of 1823. In the wars of the European powers, the president said, we have never taken part, and we should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere dangerous to our peace and safety. Happy birthday this week to the United Arab Emirates, a federation of seven sheikdoms that declared independence in early December of 1971. The poison gas tragedy at Bhopal, India, occurred 6 years ago this week. Early December birthdays include the writers Samuel Butler, Joseph Conrad, Thomas Carlyle, Willa Cather, and James Thurber. The Mexican artist Diego Rivera. The singers Maria Callas and Lillian Russell. The poet Joyce Kilmer and the composer Ira Gershwin, the musician Dave Brubeck, and the eighth American president, Martin Van Buren. Finally, this week marks an anniversary for the repeal of Prohibition that occurred in December of 1933 and for the first encounter between Christopher Columbus and the people of the New World, which occurred on the island of San Salvador in early December of 1492. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Revolutionary Observers, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Mel Richter of Hunter College discusses Alexis de Tocqueville, the 19th-century observer of European and North American politics. Nikita Pokrovsky of Moscow State University discusses contemporary intellectual crosscurrents between the United States and the Soviet Union. Revolutionary Observers, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.